content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. If you've ever struggled with rejection, you might take heart in the story of Theodore Geisel, an aspiring children's book author who was turned down by 27 publishers before finally finding one who would give him a chance. It helped that he had a friend who worked there. But Geisel, now more widely known as Dr. Seuss, would achieve his greatest successes later in his career, thanks in part to a surprising development, the launch of Sputnik by the Soviet Union. As the New Yorker staff writer Louis Menand recounted in 2002, one of Dr. Seuss's signature stories, The Cat in the Hat, arrived in bookstores the same year that the satellite reached space. The Sputnik breakthrough was acutely stressful for American defense analysts, but the timing proved fortuitous for Dr. Seuss and his publisher, for reasons explained by the article. Despite containing only 1,702 words, actually 220 words, rhymed and repeated, the book presents an unexpectedly rich text as much for adults as for children. Revisiting the plot, Menand offers a provocative theory about a secret pact between the mischievous feline and the main character's missing parent. At the time the article was published, The Cat in the Hat was the fourth best-selling children's hardcover title of all time, a position that might actually understate its influence on American kids and their culture. It was a tour de force, Menand observes, and it killed Dick and Jane. And now, from the December 15th, 2002 issue of the New Yorker magazine, I will read that article, Cat People, What Dr. Seuss Really Taught Us, by Louis Menand. The Cat in the Hat was a Cold War invention. His value as an analyst of the psychology of his time, the late 1950s, is readily appreciated. Transgression and hypocrisy are the principal themes of his little story. But he also stands in an intimate and paradoxical relation to national security policy. He was both its creature and its nemesis, the unraveler of the very culture that produced him and that made him a star. This is less surprising than it may seem. He was, after all, a cat. Every reader of The Cat in the Hat will feel that the story revolves around a piece of withheld information. What private demons or desires compelled this mother to leave two young children at home all day with the front door unlocked under the supervision of a fish? Terrible as the cat is, the woman is lucky that her children do not fall prey to some more insidious intruder. The mother's abandonment is the psychic wound for which the antics of the cat make so useless a palliative. The children hate the cat. They take no joy in his stupid pet tricks, and they resent his attempt to distract them from what they really want to be doing, which is staring out the window for a sign of their mother's return. Next to that consummation, a cake on a rake is a pretty feeble entertainment. This is the fish's continually iterated point, and the fish is not wrong. The cat's pursuit of its peculiar idea of fun only cranks up the children's anxiety. It raises our anxiety level as well, since it keeps us from doing what we really want to be doing, which is accompanying the mother on her murderous or erotic errand. Possibly the mother has engaged the cat herself in order to throw the burden of suspicion onto the children. What did you do? She asks them when she returns home, knowing that the children cannot put the same question to her without disclosing their own violation of domestic taboos. They are each other's alibi. When you cheat, you lie. The decision to turn the cat in the hat on the trope of the mater abscondita is not without interest, coming as it does from a writer who chose his mother's maiden name as his pen name. Dr. Seuss was called Theodore Geisel after his father, the son of a German immigrant who settled in Springfield, Massachusetts. Dr. Seuss's mother, also the daughter of German immigrants, was Henrietta Seuss, and when he appropriated the name for his books, Dr. Seuss pronounced it in the German manner, Seuss, until he realized that Americans naturally read the name as Seuss, and that the American pronunciation of Dr. Seuss evoked a figure advantageous for an author of children's books to be associated with, Mother Goose. Henrietta Seuss was 6 feet tall and weighed nearly 200 pounds. Dr. Seuss's authorized biographers, Judith and Neil Morgan, report that she was an accomplished high diver, not a sport one can easily picture a 200-pound woman engaging in, and that she was admired for her beauty. She was a devoted reader of bedtime stories, and she encouraged her son's interest in rhyme and rhythm. The single recreation of Dr. Seuss's father was target shooting, a hobby his son once called silly and unproductive. In 1902, he held the world record for marksmanship at 200 yards. He had the misfortune of inheriting the presidency of the family brewery a month before Prohibition was declared, but he was never poor. His son attended Dartmouth and then went to Oxford, but he dropped out after less than a year. His tutor told him that he was the only man he had ever met who should never have gone to Oxford. He then tried the Sorbonne. He left that institution after 15 minutes. When he returned to the United States in 1927, he began a successful career in advertising. He became famous for his work on behalf of an insecticide called Flit. The breakthrough came in 1937 when an old Dartmouth friend, an editor at Vanguard Press, persuaded his boss to publish And to Think That I Saw It on Mulberry Street, a book that 27 other publishing houses had turned down. This was followed by a steady stream of Dr. Seuss books, including the great political trilogy, The 500 Hats of Bartholomew Cubbins, 1938, The King's Stilts, 1939, and Bartholomew and the Oobleck, 1949, and two classic studies of identity, Horton Hatches the Egg, 1940, and Horton Hears a Who, 1954. And so in 1954, when John Hersey published a piece in Life deploring the books used in public schools to teach children how to read, he called them pallid primers with abnormally courteous, unnaturally clean boys and girls. He mentioned Dr. Seuss as one of the imaginative geniuses whom publishers might turn to in the hope of enriching the books they produce for the schools. In 1955, one of those publishers took Hersey's advice. This was William Spaulding, director of the education division at Houghton Mifflin. Spaulding had read Hersey's article. He had also read a bestseller called Why Johnny Can't Read, which had come out that year. Why Johnny Can't Read was, similarly, an attack on primers, which it described as horrible, stupid, emasculated, pointless, tasteless little readers, the stuff and guff about Dick and Jane or Alice and Jerry visiting the farm and having birthday parties and seeing animals in the zoo and going through dozens and dozens of totally unexciting middle-class, middle-income, middle-IQ children's activities that offer opportunities for reading, look, look, or yes, yes, or come, come, or see the funny, funny animal. The author was Rudolf Franz Flesch, an Austrian immigre with a Ph.D. from Teachers College. His point wasn't just that the Dick and Jane and Alice and Jerry readers were boring. His point was that they were based on a flawed pedagogy. This was the theory of word recognition, the idea that children learn words by memorizing them. Flesch argued that this was an absurd way to teach reading, since it left the child without resources when confronted with an unfamiliar word. The correct method, Flesch believed, was phonics, teaching children the sounds that letters and groups of letters make. He maintained that there are 44 such sounds in English, so that they will be able to figure out unfamiliar words. Ultimately, of course, we do memorize words. We don't stop to sound them out. But Flesch thought that people could get to that stage a lot faster if they started with phonics. Flesch claimed that American children advanced much more slowly in reading than European children did. This was in the days when Americans still cared what Europeans thought of them. And he suggested that the failure of the public schools was a threat to democracy and the American dream, since it deprived poor and middle-class children of the quality of education available to the affluent. Flesch also asserted that first and second graders in our public schools are not taught to read at all, as shown by the fact that there isn't a single book on the market that they can manage to read by themselves. And this hint of an unexploited class of consumers is undoubtedly what inspired Spalding to invite Theodore Geisel to dinner. "Write me a story that first graders can't put down," he told him. There was an added requirement. In the book of Why Johnny Can't Read, Flesch had printed 72 word lists, which parents who bought the book could use to teach their children at home. Spalding asked Geisel to write a story that used only a limited number of similar words, words recognizable by a first grader. As Geisel later explained to an interviewer, "He sent me a list of about 300 words and told me to make a book out of them. At first, I thought it was impossible and ridiculous, and I was about to get out of the whole thing. Then decided to look at the list one more time and to use the first two words that rhymed as the title of the book. Cat and hat were the ones my eyes lighted on. I worked on the book for 9 months, throwing it across the room and letting it hang for a while, but I finally got it done." This makes the project seem less scientific than it was. Spalding published textbooks. He was not in the business of dreaming up brain teasers for Dr. Seuss. He really believed in Flesch's doctrine, and he wanted a book he could sell to the schools. He had already agreed to give Random House, Geisel's regular publisher, the rights to the trade edition. Spalding handed Geisel three lists drawn up by experts. The first was composed of 220 words that first graders could be expected to recognize at sight, like A, about, and, are, and so on. Geisel selected 123. The second list contained 220 words that beginning readers might recognize from phonics exercises, sets of words similar in sound, such as make and rake and cake. Geisel chose 45. And the third list contained 220 words that first graders had probably never seen but should be able to decipher, such as beat, fear, and kick. Geisel used 31. This netted him 199 words. It wasn't enough to make a story from, so he added 21 words of his own, including nothing, mess, and pink. The Cat in the Hat is 1,702 words long, but it uses only 220 different words. And, as the cat says, that is not all. Geisel put the whole thing into rhymed anapestic dimeter. It was a tour de force, and it killed Dick and Jane. It had some help from the Cold War. The idea that young people were being exposed to a commercial culture that was making them vicious and stupid was a prevalent anxiety in the mid-50s. The popularity of Why Johnny Can't Read was one symptom of that anxiety. Another was Frederick Wortham's Seduction of the Innocent, an attack on the comic book industry. Wortham was a psychiatrist who worked with problem children and delinquents. His book came out in 1954, the same year that a Senate subcommittee held widely publicized hearings on the effects of comic books on young readers, at which Wortham testified. Mad Magazine, which was started in 1952 and specialized in gory humor, was a target of the investigation. And then there was television. In 1950, 9% of American homes had a television set. In 1956, the figure was 72%. The general fear that American children were growing up in a dumbed-down culture was crystallized by the launching of Sputnik. Sputnik went into orbit on October 4, 1957, It was the size of a beach ball, and its sole technical feature was the emission of a steady beeping sound. It was a danger to no man. But that wasn't the point. The point was the missile used to launch it. Nuclear devices are not much good unless you can deliver them. And the launching of an artificial satellite suggested that the Soviets, who had exploded their first thermonuclear bomb 2 years before, were on the way to developing an ICBM capability. A month later, on November 3rd, the Soviets put a second satellite into orbit. Sputnik 2 carried a very unhappy Russian dog named Laika, which contributed a spooky mad scientist effect to the whole thing. There was panic in the United States. The accepted diagnosis was that the United States was being beaten in the arms race by a nation with a superior educational system. Sputnik was believed to have exposed a technology gap. Mortal challenge, the cover of Newsweek declared, a world at stake in science, education, diplomacy, economics, defense. The Saturday Review pointed out that without mathematics, democracy cannot hope to survive. The official response, besides an increase in funding for missile research, was the passage of the National Defense Education Act of 1958. In the present emergency, the act explained, the national interest requires that the federal government give assistance to education for programs which are important to our defense. These were identified as science, mathematics, and modern foreign languages. The National Defense Education Act of 1958 paid for loans to students, for equipment needed to teach science, math, and foreign languages, for national defense fellowships for graduate students, and for testing and guidance services. It established centers for the study of foreign languages and supported research on the use of the media for educational purposes. The fields targeted by the act were the ones that benefited most, but every area in education benefited to some degree, because resources put into one area from outside free up resources for others. The baby boom was already kicking in, and the National Defense Education Act of 1958 started a steady flow of funding for educational institutions. In the same period, the economists Theodore Schultz and Gary Becker were developing the concept of human capital, which figured an educated citizenry as an economic asset and, by inference, a national security priority. Rudolf Flesch had prevailed. The Cat in the Hat was published in March 1957, 7 months before Sputnik. Within weeks, it was selling at a rate of 12,000 copies a month. Random House's publisher, Bennett Cerf, contrived to sell his trade edition to the schools through jobbers, and he ended up acquiring the textbook rights from Houghton Mifflin. And 1957 was the peak year of the baby boom. In 1945, the last year of the war, 2.9 million children were born in the United States. In 1952, 3.9 million were born. These are the children who were 5 years old when The Cat in the Hat came out. In 1957, 4.3 million children were born, still the largest cohort in American history. By 1960, The Cat in the Hat had sold 1 million copies. By 2000, it had sold 7.2 million hardcover copies in the United States alone, making it the ninth best-selling children's hardcover book of all time. It was translated into many languages, including Latin, Catus Petisatus. The success of The Cat in the Hat persuaded Cerf to start a division at Random House called Beginner Books, and he put his wife, Phyllis, and Geisel in charge of it. They shamelessly appropriated poor, forgotten William Spaulding's model. Phyllis Cerf made a list of 379 words taken from primers. Authors could choose 200 words from this list and could add 20 emergency words of their own. Beginner Books started with four titles in 1958. By 1960, it was bringing in $1 million a year. Random House became the largest publisher of children's books in America, a third of its total sales volumes was in juvenile books. 100 beginner books were eventually published. One was Green Eggs and Ham in 1960. Bennett Cerf had bet Geisel $50 that he could not write a book using just 50 words. Geisel won the bet. 49 of the words in Green Eggs and Ham are one-syllable words. The 50th, of course, is Anywhere. Cerf didn't come out too badly, though. Green Eggs and Ham was the most successful book Dr. Seuss ever wrote. It is the fourth best-selling children's hardcover title of all time. The number one bestseller is Janet Lowry's 1942 blockbuster, The Pokey Little Puppy. The Cat in the Hat transformed the nature of primary education and the nature of children's books. It not only stood for the idea that reading ought to be taught by phonics, it also stood for the idea that language skills and many other subjects ought to be taught through illustrated storybooks rather than primers and textbooks. A few years after The Cat in the Hat came out, four-color reproduction became economically feasible. At the same time, the National Defense Act of 1958 and its successors were pumping money into school libraries. There was an apparently insatiable market for children's books with educational potential, and this drew many writers and artists into the field. Children's Lit was a Cold War growth industry right alongside Boeing, Northrop, and Dow Chemical. I am one of the 3.9 million Americans who were born in 1952, and The Cat in the Hat was the book with which I was taught by my parents to read. I remember distinctly the first word I read by myself. It was and, a word William Spalding's experts thought that a first grader should know by sight. I knew the phonetic value of each letter, ah, mm, duh. What I could not figure out was how you got from those three discrete sounds to the sound blur and. I remember the moment the switch was flipped and A-N-D turned into and. I said to myself, so that's how you do it. It is the moment you awake to the realization that there is a world available through print. A few years later, I was lying in my bed reading the third volume in the Hardy Boys Outstanding series, The Secret of the Old Mill, 86 on the big list. My heart pounding as Frank and Joe peeked through the floorboards of the old mill and watched the counterfeiters at work inches below them. Before the switch was flipped, the marks on the page had been opaque. Now they were affecting my heart rate. It is fun to have fun, but you have to know how. The cat's improvisations with the objet trouvé in the home he has invaded are obviously an allegory for his creator's performance with the 220 arbitrary words he has been assigned by his publisher. The cat is bricoleur. He has no system, or rather, his system is to have no system. He is compelled to make meaning from whatever there is. He fails. The bricolage topples. The fish ends up in a teapot, and this hint of semantic instability is expanded on in Dr. Seuss's most difficult work, number 26 all time, The Cat in the Hat Comes Back, published in 1958. The Cat in the Hat Comes Back is a grammatology of Dr. Seuss. It is a book about language and structure, those Cold War obsessions. That the cat book's appearance coincided with the publication of Noam Chomsky's Syntactic Structures in 1957 and Claude Levi-Strauss's Structural Anthropology in 1958 is, as they used to say during the Cold War, no accident. Chomsky's work in linguistics, it might be noted, was supported in part by the U.S. Army Signal Corps, the Air Force's Office of Scientific Research and Air Research and Development Command, and the Office of Naval Research. Not all of the increase in military spending went into missile research. Synopsis of The Cat in the Hat Comes Back is easy enough. Abandoned again by their feckless mothers, these two sad sacks, Sally and me, are consigned to shoveling snow from a recent blizzard. The cat chooses the moment to make his return. Sally urges her brother to bar his entrance. "Don't you talk to that cat. That cat is a bad one." The cat brushes off the brush off and enters the house, where he is discovered soon after in the tub, eating a cake. He is banished from the tub by the boy. "I have no time for tricks. I must go back and dig." But when the water is drained, a pink stain is left. The rest of the action concerns the problem of getting rid of the stain. It is first transferred by the cat to a series of household items, some plainly off limits to the children, including the mother's dress, the father's shoes, and the bed in what is described as Dad's bedroom, no doubt a response to the mother's extramarital adventures. Unable to erase the stain, the cat reveals under his hat various little cats named for the letters of the alphabet. "He helps me a lot. This is little cat A." These semiotic felines do exactly what a deconstructionist would predict. Rather than containing the stain, they disseminate it. Everything turns pink. The chain of signification is interminable, and being interminable, indeterminate. The semantic hygiene fetishized by the children is rudely violated. The system they imagine is revealed to have no inside and no outside. It is revealed to be, in fact, just another bricolage. The only way to end the spreading stain of semiosis is to unleash what, since it cannot be named, must be termed that which is not a sign. This is the VOOM, V-O-O-M, the final agent in the cat's arsenal. The VOOM eradicates the pink queerness of a textuality without boundaries. Whiteness is back, though now it is the purity of absence. One wants to say, and at this point, why not, of abstinence. The association with nuclear holocaust and its sterilizing fallout, wiping the planet clean of pinkness and pinkos, is impossible to ignore. It is a strange story for teaching people how to read. When you look through the secondary literature on The Cat in the Hat, you read that children instinctively respond to the cat's sense of mischief. I wonder how many children really do react that way. My own identification as a child was entirely with the fish. I didn't admire his hysteria, of course, very uncool, but I understood what he was trying with his limited vocabulary to say, which is that fun is only a distraction from the reality of separation and abandonment. Pink snow and those personified genitalia, thing one and thing two, are no substitute for what we have lost. We don't want to be amused. We don't even want to amuse ourselves. We want to be taken care of. Later on in the 1960s, I, along with many other Americans born around 1952, began to understand the cat's appeal, in particular, the whole thing one and thing two business. The fish, let's face it, was an uptight little dude, a tin pot Puritan, and the domestic sphere in which he served as resident superego proved, on closer examination, to be a site of exclusion and oppression. New combinations seemed possible, seemed necessary. Maybe bricolage and différence were the way, after all. Misrule became the new rule, and the cat was its cockeyed lord. Having learned to read, we learned to misread. Phonics, which was supposed to make us into super scientists, cooking up formulas for landing those ICBMs right in Khrushchev's kitchen, had unleashed instead the spirit of anything goes. Dr. Seuss, too, flushed with the wealth of his contributions to the national security had brought him, fell prey to the countercultural forces that his own cat, one of the Cold War's most potent unguided missiles, had helped set in motion. In 1971, he published The Lorax, a book about the environment that was much despised by the patriotic timber industry. And in 1984, he brought out The Butter Battle Book, a work criticizing, of all things, the arms race. The Butter Battle book was attacked in the New Republic for being soft on communism. That's not the kind of thing people used to say about the pokey little puppy. Dr. Seuss took the same course as that other doctor who hitched a ride on the baby boom and the government gravy train it rode through school and into college, Dr. Spock. They went pink. We won't get into the later career of Noam Chomsky. But that was then, a long time ago. Now we have something different. We have anything goes without the spirit. Transgression, subversion, deconstruction are praisewords bestowed as solemnly as structure and order once were little gold stars awarded to rappers and television comics. Cakes on rakes are everywhere. A million cats cavort frantically for our attention. Even the fish has been co-opted, though what choice did he have? Enjoy, cries the fish. Consume. Everything will be fine when your mother gets home. But the fish is whistling into the wind. The mother has left, and she's never coming back. It's just us and that goddamn cat. Next, from the October 4th, 2010 edition of the New Yorker magazine, Later, by James Surowiecki. Some years ago, the economist George Akerlof found himself faced with a simple task, mailing a box of clothes from India, where he was living, to the United States. The clothes belonged to his friend and colleague Joseph Stiglitz, who had left them behind when visiting, so Akerlof was eager to send the box off. But there was a problem. The combination of Indian bureaucracy and what Akerlof called my own ineptitude in such manners meant that doing so was going to be a hassle. Indeed, he estimated that it would take an entire workday. So he put off dealing with it, week after week. This went on for more than 8 months, and it was only shortly before Akerlof himself returned home that he managed to solve his problem. Another friend happened to be sending some things back to the U.S., and Akerlof was able to add Stiglitz's clothes to the shipment. Given the vagaries of intercontinental mail, it's possible that Akerlof made it back to the States before Stiglitz's shirts did. There's something comforting about this story. Even Nobel-winning economists procrastinate. Many of us go through life with an array of undone tasks, large and small, nibbling at our conscience. But Akerlof saw the experience, for all its familiarity, as mysterious. He genuinely intended to send the box to his friend, yet, as he wrote in a paper called Procrastination and Obedience, 1991, each morning for over 8 months I woke up and decided that the next morning would be the day to send the Stiglitz box. He was always about to send the box, but the moment to act never arrived. Akerlof, who became one of the central figures in behavioral economics, came to the realization that procrastination might be more than just a bad habit. He argued that it revealed something important about the limits of rational thinking and that it could teach useful lessons about phenomena as diverse as substance abuse and savings habits. Since his essay was published, the study of procrastination has become a significant field in academia, with philosophers, psychologists, and economists all weighing in. Academics, who work for long periods in a self-directed fashion, may be especially prone to putting things off. Surveys suggest that the vast majority of college students procrastinate, and the articles in the literature of procrastination often allude to the author's own problems with finishing the piece. This article will be no exception. But the academic buzz around the subject isn't just a case of eggheads rationalizing their slothfulness. As various scholars argue in The Thief of Time, edited by Chrysoula Andrieu and Mark D. White, published by Oxford, a collection of essays on procrastination ranging from the resolutely theoretical to the surprisingly practical, the tendency raises fundamental philosophical and psychological issues. You may have thought the last time you blew off work on a presentation to watch How I Met Your Mother that you were just slacking. But from another angle, you were actually engaging in a practice that illuminates the fluidity of human identity and the complicated relationship human beings have to time. Indeed, one essay by the economist George Ainslie, a central figure in the study of procrastination, argues that dragging our heels is as fundamental as the shape of time and could well be called the basic impulse. Ainslie is probably right that procrastination is a basic human impulse, but anxiety about it as a serious problem seems to have emerged in the early modern era. The term itself, derived from a Latin word meaning to put off for tomorrow, entered the English language in the 16th century, and by the 18th, Samuel Johnson was describing it as one of the general weaknesses that prevail to a greater or less degree in every mind, and lamenting the tendency in himself. I could not forbear to reproach myself for having so long neglected what was unavoidably to be done, and of which every moment's idleness increased the difficulty. And the problem seems to be getting worse all the time. According to Piers Steele, a business professor at the University of Calgary, the percentage of people who admitted to difficulties with procrastination quadrupled between 1978 and 2002. In that light, it's possible to see procrastination as a quintessential modern problem. It's also a surprisingly costly one. Each year, Americans waste hundreds of millions of dollars because they don't file their taxes on time. The Harvard economist David Leibson has shown that American workers have foregone huge amount of money in matching 401k contributions because they never got around to signing up for a retirement plan. 70% of patients suffering from glaucoma risk blindness because they don't use their eye drops regularly. Procrastination also inflicts major costs on businesses and governments. The recent crisis of the euro was exacerbated by the German government's dithering, and the decline of the American auto industry, exemplified by the bankruptcy of General Motors, was due in part to executive penchant for delaying tough decisions. In Alex Taylor's recent history of General Motors, 60-0, one of the key conclusions is procrastination does not pay. Philosophers are interested in procrastination for another reason. It's a powerful example of what the Greeks called akrasia, doing something against one's own better judgment. Piers Steele defines procrastination as willingly deferring something even though you expect the delay to make you worse off. In other words, if you're simply saying, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die, you're not really procrastinating. Knowingly delaying because you think that's the most efficient use of your time doesn't count either. The essence of procrastination lies in not doing what you think you should be doing, a mental contortion that surely accounts for the great psychic toll the habit takes on people. This is the perplexing thing about procrastination. Although it seems to involve avoiding unpleasant tasks, indulging in it generally doesn't make people happy. In one study, 65% of students surveyed before they started working on a term paper said they would like to avoid procrastinating. They knew both that they wouldn't do the work on time and that the delay would make them unhappy. Most of the contributors to the new book agree that this peculiar irrationality stems from our relationship to time, in particular, from a tendency that economists call hyperbolic discounting. A two-stage experiment provides a classic illustration. In the first stage, people are offered the choice between $100 today or $110 tomorrow. In the second stage, they choose between $100 a month from now on or $110 a month and a day from now on. In substance, the two choices are identical. Wait an extra day, get an extra $10. Yet in the first stage, many people choose to take the smaller sum immediately, whereas in the second, they prefer to wait one more day and get the extra $10. In other words, hyperbolic discounters are able to make the rational choice when they're thinking about the future, but as the present gets closer, short-term considerations overwhelm their long-term goals. A similar phenomenon is at work in an experiment run by a group including the economist George Lowenstein, in which people were asked to pick one movie to watch that night and one to watch at a later date. Not surprisingly, for the movie they wanted to watch immediately, people tended to pick lowbrow comedies and blockbusters. But when asked what movie they wanted to watch later, they were more likely to pick serious, important films. The problem, of course, is that when the time comes to watch the serious movie, another frothy one will often seem more appealing. This is why Netflix queues are filled with movies that never get watched. Our responsible selves put Hotel Rwanda and The Seventh Seal in our queue. But when the time comes, we end up in front of a rerun of The Hangover. The lesson of these experiments is not that people are short-sighted or shallow, but that their preferences aren't consistent over time. We want to watch the Bergman masterpiece to give ourselves enough time to write the report properly, to set aside money for retirement. But our desires shift as the long run becomes the short run. Why does this happen? One common answer is ignorance. Socrates believed that akrasia was, strictly speaking, impossible, since we could not want what is bad for us. If we act against our own interest, it must be because we don't know what's right. Lowenstein, similarly, is inclined to see the procrastinator as led astray by the visceral rewards of the present. As the 19th century Scottish economist John Ray put it, the prospects of future good, which future years may hold on us, seems at such a moment dull and dubious, and are apt to be slighted for objects on which the daylight is falling strongly and showing us in all their freshness just within our grasp. Lowenstein also suggests that our memory for the intensity of visceral rewards is deficient. When we put off preparing for that meeting by telling ourselves that we'll do it tomorrow, we fail to take into account that tomorrow the temptation to put off work will be just as strong. Ignorance might also affect procrastination through what the social scientist John Elster calls the planning fallacy. Elster thinks that people underestimate the time it will take them to complete a given task, partly because they fail to take account of how long it has taken them to complete similar projects in the past, and partly because they rely on smooth scenarios in which accidents or unforeseen problems never occur. When I was writing this piece, for instance, I had to take my car into the shop. I had to take two unanticipated trips, a family member fell ill, and so on. Each of these events was, strictly speaking, unexpected, and each took time away from my work. But they were really just the kinds of problems you predictably have to deal with in everyday life. Pretending I wouldn't have any interruptions to my work was a typical illustration of the planning fallacy. Still, ignorance can't be the whole story. In the first place, we often procrastinate, not by doing fun tasks, but by doing jobs whose only allure is that they aren't what we should be doing. My apartment, for instance, has rarely looked tidier than it does at the moment. And people do learn from experience. Procrastinators know all too well the allures of the salient present, and they want to resist them. They just don't. A magazine editor I know, for instance, once had a writer tell her at noon on a Wednesday that the time-sensitive piece he was working on would be in her inbox by the time she got back from lunch. She did eventually get the piece the following Tuesday. So a fuller explanation of procrastination really needs to take account of our attitudes to the task being avoided. A useful example can be found in the career of General George McClellan, who led the Army of the Potomac during the early years of the Civil War and was one of the greatest procrastinators of all time. When he took charge of the Union Army, McClellan was considered a military genius, but he soon became famous for his chronic hesitancy. In 1862, despite an excellent opportunity to take Richmond from Robert E. Lee's men with another Union Army attacking in a pincer move, he dilly-dallied, convinced that he was blocked by hordes of Confederate soldiers and missed his chance. Later that year, both before and after Antietam, he delayed again, squandering a 2-to-1 advantage over Lee's troops. Afterward, Union General-in-Chief Henry Halleck wrote, "There is an immobility here that exceeds all that any man can conceive of. It requires the lever of Archimedes to move this inert mass. McClellan's immobility highlights several classic reasons we procrastinate. Although when he took over the Union Army, he told Lincoln, "I can do it all," he seems to have been unsure that he could do anything. He was perpetually imploring Lincoln for new weapons and, in the words of one observer, he felt he never had troops well enough trained or equipped. Lack of confidence, sometimes alternating with unrealistic dreams of heroic success, often leads to procrastination. And many studies suggest that procrastinators are self-handicappers. Rather than risk failure, they prefer to create conditions that make success impossible, a reflex that, of course, creates a vicious cycle. McClellan was also given to excessive planning, as if only the ideal battle plan were worth acting on. Procrastinators often succumb to this sort of perfectionism. Viewed this way, procrastination starts to look less like a question of mere ignorance than like a complex mixture of weakness, ambition, and inner conflict. But some of the philosophers in The Thief of Time have a more radical explanation for the gap between what we want to do and what we end up doing. The person who makes plans and the person who fails to carry them out are not really the same person. They're different parts of what the game theorist Thomas Schelling called the divided self. Schelling proposes that we think of ourselves not as unified selves, but as different beings, jostling, contending, and bargaining for control. Ian McEwan evokes this state in his recent novel, Solar. McEwan writes, "At moments of important decision-making, the mind could be considered as a parliament, a debating chamber. Different factions contended, short and long-term interests were entrenched in mutual loathing. Not only were motions tabled and opposed, certain proposals were aired in order to mask others. Sessions could be devious as well as stormy." Similarly, Otto von Bismarck said, "Faust complained about having two souls in his breast, but I harbor a whole crowd of them, and they quarrel. It is like being in a republic." In that sense, the first step to dealing with procrastination isn't admitting that you have a problem. It's admitting that your yous have a problem. If identity is a collection of competing selves, what does each of them represent? The easy answer is that one represents your short-term interests, having fun, putting off work, and so on, while another represents your long-term goals. But if that's the case, it's not obvious how you'd ever get anything done. The short-term self, it seems, would always win out. The philosopher Don Ross offers a persuasive solution to the problem. For Ross, the various parts of the self are all present at once, constantly competing and bargaining with one another, one that wants to work, one that wants to watch television, and so on. The key for Ross is that although the television-watching self is interested only in watching TV, it's interested in watching TV not just now, but also in the future. This means that it can be bargained with. Working now will let you watch more television down the road. Procrastination in this reading is the result of a bargaining process gone wrong. The idea of the divided self, though discomforting to some, can be liberating in practical terms because it encourages you to stop thinking about procrastination as something you can beat by just trying harder. Instead, we should rely on what Joseph Heath and Joel Anderson in their essay in The Thief of Time called the extended will, external tools and techniques to help the parts of ourselves that want to work. A classic illustration of the extended will at work is Ulysses' decision to have his men bind him to the mast of his ship. Ulysses knows that when he hears the sirens, he will be too weak to resist steering the ship onto the rocks in pursuit of them, so he has his men bind him, thereby forcing him to adhere to his long-term aims. Similarly, Thomas Schelling once said that he would be willing to pay extra in advance for a hotel room without a television in it. Today, problem gamblers write contracts with the casinos banning them from the premises. And people who are trying to lose weight or finish a project will sometimes make bets with their friends so that if they don't deliver on their promise, it'll cost them money. In 2008, a PhD candidate at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, wrote software that enables people to shut off their access to the internet for up to 8 hours. The program, called Freedom, now has an estimated 75,000 users. Not everyone in The Thief of Time approves of the reliance on the extended will. Mark D. White advances an idealist argument rooted in Kantian ethics. Recognizing procrastination as a failure of will, we should seek to strengthen the will rather than relying on external controls that will allow it to atrophy further. This isn't a completely fruitless task. Much recent research suggests that willpower is, in some ways, like a muscle and can be made stronger. The same research, though, also suggests that most of us have a limited amount of willpower and that it's easily exhausted. In one famous study, people who have been asked to restrain themselves from readily available temptation, in this case a pile of chocolate chip cookies that they weren't allowed to touch, had a harder time persisting in a difficult task than people who were allowed to eat the cookies. Given this tendency, it makes sense that we often rely intuitively on external rules to help ourselves out. A few years ago, Dan Ariely, a psychologist at MIT, did a fascinating experiment examining one of the most basic external tools for dealing with procrastination, deadlines. Students in a class were assigned 3 papers for the semester, and they were given a choice. They could set separate deadlines for when they had to hand in each of the papers, or they could hand them all in together at the end of the semester. There was no benefit to handing the papers in early, since they were all going to be graded at semester's end, and there was a potential cost to setting the deadlines, since if you missed a deadline, your grade would be docked. So the rational thing to do was to hand in all the papers at the end of the semester. That way you'd be free to write the papers sooner, but not at risk of a penalty if you didn't get around to it. Yet, most of the students chose to set separate deadlines for each paper, precisely because they knew that they were otherwise unlikely to get around to working on the papers early, which meant they ran the risk of not finishing all 3 by the end of the semester. This is the essence of the extended will. Instead of trusting themselves, the students relied on an outside tool to make themselves do what they actually wanted to do. Beyond self-binding, there are other ways to avoid dragging your feet, most of which depend on what psychologists might call reframing the task in front of you. Procrastination is driven in part by the gap between effort, which is required now, and reward, which you reap only in the future, if ever. So narrowing that gap by whatever means necessary helps. Since open-ended tasks with distant deadlines are much easier to postpone than focused short-term projects, dividing projects into smaller, more defined sections helps. That's why David Allen, the author of the best-selling time management book, Getting Things Done, lays great emphasis on classification and definition. The vaguer the task, or the more abstract the thinking it requires, the less likely you are to finish it. One German study suggests that just getting people to think about concrete problems, like how to open a bank account, makes them better at finishing their work, even when it deals with a completely different subject. Another way of making procrastination less likely is to reduce the amount of choice we have. Often, when people are afraid of making the wrong choice, they end up doing nothing. So companies might be better off offering their employees fewer investment choices in their 401k plans and making signing up for the plan the default option. It's hard to ignore the fact that all these tools are at root about imposing limits and narrowing options. In other words, about a voluntary abnegation of freedom. Victor Hugo would write naked and tell his valet to hide his clothes so that he'd be unable to go outside when he was supposed to be writing. But before we rush to overcome procrastination, we should consider whether it is sometimes an impulse we should heed. The philosopher Mark Kingwell puts it in existential terms. Procrastination most often arises from a sense that there is too much to do, and hence no single aspect of the to-do worth doing. Underneath this rather antic form of action as inaction is the much more unsettling question whether anything is worth doing at all. In that sense, it might be useful to think about two kinds of procrastination. The kind that is genuinely acratic, and the kind that's telling you that what you're supposed to be doing has, deep down, no real point. The procrastinator's challenge, and perhaps the philosopher's too, is to figure out which is which. And now a poem from the April 8, 2024 issue of the New Yorker magazine. Today, My Hope is Vertical by Jane Hirschfield. Today, my hope is vertical. Tomorrow, it will be horizontal. The next day, cloudy. My hope is like a Greek myth, exchanging skin for bark, bark for scales, scales for the hollow bones of a bird. In these ways, my hope attempts to escape its fate. In myth, hope surely known, escape is useless. Still, hope will try. I, who will someday leave behind this three-dimensional puzzle, pity my hope. Poorling, I say to my hope, even I cannot spare you. Even I cannot make you mortal. Winged, rooted, finned, roofed, or roofless, of all my shapes, only you, hope, know nothing of irony. Only you cannot be cynical or cloak yourself in the objectivity of grammar. Only you cannot suffer suffering. You exempt, you deny, you protest with speech and with silence. You forgive, helpless to not, in speech and in silence. I, citizen of perspective, born into the tribe of time, will vanish into its blurring distance. But you, most intransigent, most stubborn of all my parts, will be forced to continue. How tenderly, with two open hands, you reach again today for hunger's apple. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.